Okay, I'd like to call the April 17th, 2007 Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. We're down in the basement today, hearing room 50, and I am very excited to be able to move a whole lot of bills today, I'm hoping. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 925, and I'd like to request Senator Betsy Johnson to come forward. Is there anyone else that you'd like to come with? Yeah, and John.
Why don't you invite her husband up, too, Jeff Roy? Invite her husband up, too. Roy, invite her husband, John.
And John, you can come up, too.
Yeah, Javi, why don't you come up, Javi?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16.
And who's with you, please?
Madam Chair, Mr. President, my staff assistant, John Helm.
Oh, that's okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair, first I would like to express to you my deep appreciation on the courtesy that you have extended to me with respect to this legislation, both in helping to craft it and in allowing me to testify tonight. I'm AWOL from a hearing upstairs, and so I very much appreciate your courtesy in doing this. The genesis of this legislation came, and forgive me, this is going to be somewhat emotional testimony for me to give, but the genesis of this bill came from an experience that I had this last year. On the Friday before Christmas, my mother came home from St. Charles Medical Center at age 93 in extremis and in the care of hospice. She was dying. And in an attempt to keep her in her own home as long as possible, my sister and I turned to providers in the local area in an attempt to have, at a minimum, a CNA with her 24 hours a day, and at a maximum, an RN. Money was not an issue for us. We were looking for the best care possible. We identified a company called At Home Care Group in Bend, and I brought copies of their advertisement with me. We went so far because both my sister and I were a little anxious about hiring this kind of service, having never done it before. We went to the effort to ask a friend, Barbara Glidewell, who is a nurse advocate at OHSU and very experienced in these matters, to interview the manager, the on-site manager of the company, to assure us that we had the kind of quality care that we wanted for our mother. And over the telephone and in the interviews, they made all kinds of representations about what they could and could not do to help a dying elderly woman. And so the first night that they sent someone was the Saturday of the weekend before Christmas. I was there alone. I am not trained in the caring professions. I'm trained as a lawyer. And so the young lady that arrived, when I showed her the list of medications, she indicated to me that she was not capable of handling or dispensing any of those medications. As is typical with hospice patients, they often are on a regimen of pretty intense drugs, including narcotics such as morphine. I asked her why she was not competent to dispense any of these drugs, and she informed me that she had no medical training at all. She was a caregiver. We had not hired somebody to water the plants or feed the cat while we were in Hawaii. We had contracted, we believe, for trained medical expertise to be with our in extremis mother. Fortunately, nothing happened during the night, and the next day I set about finding out what are the qualifications for people that are holding out advertisements in the newspaper or in phone books saying that they provide these kinds of services. I was horrified as the course of our relationship deteriorated with At Home Care Group to discover that not only were they not providing us with the level of expertise and certification, but they also had not background checked, drug tested, or in fact checked the certificates, the credentialing of any of the people. Obviously, this relationship deteriorated very quickly, and on the Tuesday following Christmas Monday, I went down and canceled payment on the check, and we continued to argue over the what they perceive as the outstanding indebtedness for the, quote, services that they provided. As I reflected on this situation, it occurs to me that as more of us that are of the boomer generation come in need of these services, that this is an industry, while there are some wonderful companies providing excellent service and doing the kind of background checks and credentialing that are appropriate, there are others that are not. And so with the indulgence of this committee, I hope to be able, with this bill, to bring an additional level of oversight to the industry. And again, I want to say very clearly, I believe that there are many companies providing this kind of service to Oregonians that do allow people to remain independent and stay in their own homes or die in the comfort and security of their own bedrooms. But for those that aren't, I'm hopeful that this bill will bring an additional level of oversight that will make sure that people are receiving the services that they contract for. I believe in this instance that this particular company's behavior bordered on fraud and negligence with respect to the experience that we had. But I'm hopeful with the committee's indulgence that this bill will move forward and that we will be able to assure Oregonians that the services that they contract for from the providers in this profession that are not of the highest caliber, that there will be appropriate oversight from the Department of Human Services to make sure that no one else finds themselves in the frightening situation that I found myself in that Saturday before Christmas.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Is there any questions?
I do. Senator Johnson, can you...
Now, this is the gut and stuff, so...
Oh.
So don't pay attention to what the bill says in front of you.
So where are the amendments?
The amendments will be coming. I think John Helm is going to be...
They should be in your packet as well.
The
desk, too.
And Madam Chair, one of the reasons that I asked Mr. Helm to join me is given the rigors of the legislative schedule, I have relied on him very heavily to be negotiating with interested parties to this bill to make sure that we had amendments that were reflective of agreement with both DHS, Dr. Higginson, who I think you will hear from later, helped us. Jim Anderson and his staff was enormously helpful. Who else?
Lauren Rhodes and Sarah.
From representing the hospice providers. And through John's good offices, I think we were able to accommodate concerns that people had. And while I have not personally spoken with many of these people, I hope that what you will see is a parade of folks coming forward in support of the bill. I think you will hear from Dr. Higginson that there may be some costs associated with providing an effective level of enforcement and oversight, and these were not contemplated in the governor's budget. In the governor's recommended budget, I think that there are proposed fees in the dash twos that Dr. Higginson, may indicate are insufficient to meet the requirements of an aggressive inspection schedule. It is my hope through the Ways and Means process to at least have the opportunity to make the case to the committee so capably chaired by Senator Carter that this might be something for consideration by their committee, but I readily want to admit and recognize that for a bill like this to work, the enforcement and oversight piece has to be there, and there are expenses attached to that enforcement and oversight. So there are some elements of this bill not fully developed with respect to the financial requirements of oversight. In one of the conversations that I was privy to, the number $100,000 surfaced to make sure that there's adequate oversight. I just want the committee to know that I'm cognizant of the fact that there could be some fiscal ramifications to this bill.
Okay. And who is going to be going through describing what the dash twos say?
At this point, Dr. Higginson may be able to assist with the dash twos. Having just slipped out of my land use fairness, I don't have the dash twos with.
Okay. Yes, Dr. Higginson, you can come up. And then let's bring Sarah Myers up also.
And I am happy to stay through the remainder of the testimony. I also brought just for your bill files the copy of the advertisement that came from the telephone book over in Bend.
I think that'd be very helpful. And this is an issue that was dealt with several years ago. We had a constituent, the former mayor of Gresham, Gussie McRobert, who had similar issues regarding these home care agencies. So hopefully this is going to really beef that up.
Well, it's ironic that former Mayor McRoberts and my mother were friends, and so this has a certain full circle feeling to it, and I just would ask your support and consideration of the bill.
Thank you very much,
Senator. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Graham Higginson, and I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to discuss issues with regarding the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 958, which you've heard would provide more clarity and regulatory oversight for in-home care agencies. And I think you know by now that one of the things that my office does is have a program called Healthcare Licensing and Certification, which licenses and or certifies a number of healthcare facilities and or agencies, and two of the agencies that we have oversight over are in-home care agencies and home health agencies. So when Senate Bill 958 came into play, we did talk with Senator Johnson, and we reviewed the statute for both in-home care and home health.
Pull the microphone a little bit closer to you.
Is that better?
Let's see.
Okay. And so when we reviewed the statute in regarding both of these agencies, we identified what we thought were five deficiencies. The first is we thought that there were inadequate sanctions against in-home care agencies for unacceptable practices such as false advertising and failure to provide contracted services. That kind of thing, yes. The second thing is that in-home care agencies are allowed to provide some nursing services, but at least from our perspective and compared to home health agencies, we think that the oversight of those nursing services is inadequate. A third thing is that the definition of what nursing services in-home care agencies can provide, we believe, is vague. This is all in current statute. And then the fourth thing is that, and this is unrelated to in-home care, is that home health agency services are much more clearly defined and have very clear and good professional and administrative oversight. However, because of the way the bill is written, only those services that are providing intermittent nursing care services are covered under the law. Consequently, if an agency is providing 24/7 nursing services or are providing daily nursing services, we do not believe that they are covered. And then the fifth thing, as has been mentioned already, we think that the statutory fees are currently inadequate to cover appropriate regulatory oversight. So we support the concepts of this bill because we do believe that the issues of inadequate sanctions and insufficient professional oversight of nursing services have been addressed in this bill. However, a couple other issues, the vague definition of services that can be provided, nursing services for in-home care agencies, and the issue of what we believe are some unregulated nursing services being provided in the home, those issues have not been dealt with. And I know that those things I just don't think can be dealt with this session, but it would welcome legislative direction that those things are things that we should be working on over the interim and bring back to next legislative session. And then finally, the thing I need to also mention is regarding fees. Two things is that this increase, as Senator Johnson mentioned, is not contemplated in the governor's recommended budget. And also, in addition, when we reviewed the proposed fee schedule in the Dash 2 amendments, we do not believe that that would be enough money to get us to where we think we need to be to allow us to provide regular inspections of in-home care agencies every 3 years and aggressive follow-up of any and investigations of any complaints. And so we would recommend if there is going to be a fee increase, one way to do it would be to raise it to $750 for both initial and renewal fee. And
rather than the $1,500 that's mentioned in the bill?
What was mentioned in the bill is changing from three, well, actually changing from an initial, which I believe was
line 13.
Right, and an initial would go to from 500 to 1500, and a renewal would go from 350 to 500.
So in this particular the amendment that we have, the Dash 2, say it will be 350. So you want to change that to 500?
Well, actually, 350 is for a change in ownership, I believe.
Oh, that's ownership. So
right.
Where's
right. So
I found it. I found it.
So you're wanting the 5 to be 5. You're wanting the 15 to be 5. And the 5 to be 5. No?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, rather than having 15 for initial and 500 for renewals, we would prefer to have 750 for either
for both.
Initial or renewal.
Okay.
And the 350 would be fine because we have very few of those changes.
Is this something that would need to be that could be changed over in the House? Could it be changed in Ways and Means? Rather than, it's taking us so long to get amendments that I want to move the bill, and if it's the dollar amount that could be changed in Ways and Means, I assume that that could happen.
And Madam Chair, I would too hate to see this held up over something as simple as that. I can't address that question. Someone like Senator Carter would be much better able to address that.
Okay, before we move on, so Senator Carter, on page 2, lines 6, it states $1,500, and what the department is suggesting, change that to $750, and on line 9, changing $500 to $750. Is that something that you...
Line 10 as well.
And line 10. And line 10. 750. Is that correct? Could you check?
I'm sure that's correct.
Okay. Is that something that we should have amendments in this committee for, or could that be done in Ways and Means?
As long as you're not requiring an amount to be in that allocation committee. But with you changing the fee structure here, I don't see that would be a problem.
For you?
Ways,
I wouldn't think so. It's
the dollar. It's the money issue.
Yeah,
it's not policy.
Change, no, so. It's
not. So I think it
could
be done here.
Would you prefer it be done here?
It's a fiscal matter. It usually goes to Ways and Means, but I'm saying since you're not dispersing or requesting that Ways and Means pay out a dollar amount, I just don't see whether it would be a problem.
So that means we would really need an amendment here, is what
well,
I...
Well...
So then just send it to Ways and Means.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
We will draft the amendments and have them end up in Ways and Means. We will draft the amendments and have it go with the bill. And I'm sorry, President Courtney, I know you like to have amendments, but at this point in time, with amendments, do you have anything to say?
I want to ask a question about amendment. Could I?
Yes.
Dr. Gibson, I don't know if this question should go to you on line 6 of page 1. They delete shall and say may. Why is that? Why is that? I mean, it seems to me, this is coming at me very fast, but if this is a significant legitimate issue for us to direct, why do you delete the word shall and insert the word may?
If I may, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Courtney, Sarah Myers, representing the Oregon Association for Home Care, myself and Lauren Rhodes had worked on the draft for the -2 amendment, and we asked the very same question and asked LC to change that from back to the original language from shall, you know, back to shall versus may, and we did not receive that in the -2, so I'm not sure why that was changed, but it seems to me that it would have been more forceful had it remained shall versus may.
Absolutely.
But now we're getting into some very interesting situations in terms of Ways and Means, to be very frank with you.
Yeah,
that is a significant change.
It is.
Okay, that's fine. We know we have the direction. We can. I just hope that every amendment we get isn't going to be like this. But yeah, I mean, we need to make the changes. We'll send it. And it'll be an easy fix. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. Grant, other than what we've just discussed, you're supportive of the -2.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, yes, we're supportive of what the -2s are doing. We think it's getting us along the road to where we need to be.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would suggest that the changes should be relatively quick. It's not rewriting the bill, it's just changing some numbers and deleting a may. Well, actually, that's just going back to original language on page one. I would think that would be a relatively easy amendment.
I don't.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I think if you're talking shall, then we're talking a mandate there at that point. Are you thinking that it'll cost you more money to do the regulatory work if you were to keep the word shall in as opposed to may?
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, we're not the ones that asked for the change for shall to may, and whether it is shall or may, we would plan on doing the same level of oversight either way, so it would not make a difference in the fiscal.
Madam Chair, I'm not prepared to support it with the may in it. I want to go back to the original language and get the shall.
Senator Montes-Anderson, if I may, we did not request that it be changed. It came out of LC that way, unfortunately, and we agree that it should remain as shall.
Thank you. Any further questions for Dr. Higginson? All right. Thank you.
For the record, again, Sarah Myers representing the Oregon Association for Home Care, the Executive Director. As Dr. Higginson has mentioned, our organization represents skilled providers of home health agencies, hospices, and also in-home care agencies. In the sake of brevity, I wanted to simply just give you a little bit of background. As Senator Montes-Anderson remembers about this particular issue, this did arise from a particular circumstance very similar to Senator Johnson's that Gussie McRoberts, former mayor of Gresham, had experienced, and such has resulted in the in-home care licensure statute back in 1999. And following that time in 2002, the rules for administering that licensure were implemented. We were an instrumental part of that process during that time in terms of our representation of the home care industry, and we have been in existence in our organization since 1970. Home health agency licensure has existed for over 30 years. So we have quite a lot of experience with respect to our state licensure, as well as the fact that all agencies in the state of Oregon under home health are Medicare certified. So we are not only subject to state licensure, but also to the federal conditions of participation under Medicare certification. So there are some very stringent requirements that home health agencies must adhere to. With respect to in-home care agencies, it's a lot of more in terms of the supportive services versus a skilled service that home health agencies provide. However, we understand that there's a lot of difficulty in navigating for the general consumer in terms of their understanding of what home care means and what it is. And a lot of times those decisions are made in a situation where it's urgent and you're attempting to find the most appropriate care for your loved one or for yourself in a situation where you may not fully understand all of the options that are available to you. But I think in terms of the natural maturation of this particular licensure, we are very supportive of the changes and have worked very closely with the Oregon Health Care Association in drafting the Dash 2 amendments. Our apologies that they are not exactly as we would have liked them to be to present them to the committee to date. But certainly we're very supportive of these in terms of adding the necessary oversight that the Department of Human Services Healthcare Licensure and Certification needs to authorize and oversee the activities of in-home care agencies, which in the last few years since the administrative rules were implemented have proliferated in the state. To date, we have about 60 home health agencies, but there are more than 120 in-home care agencies that we know of. And I would surmise that potentially there are other agencies out there or companies out there that may not yet be licensed. So we certainly hope that this will provide some more oversight and some greater ability of the department to manage this growing industry. And with that, I will conclude my comments and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
So this amendment will mean that any in-home care agency must be licensed by the state. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct, although as Ms. Myers suggests, we rely on an agency to present themselves for licensure. It's not necessarily everyone would be licensed, but they would be licensed if we knew about them.
And is there any sanctions if they are not licensed and frauding the public, or do we have to just wait for a complaint to come?
And Madam Chair, yes, that actually is specifically addressed in page 3, section 4 of the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, if it would be appropriate, perhaps we could call up Lauren Rhodes from the Oregon Healthcare Association. We'd be happy to go through the amendments and discuss with you the various different sections of the
amendment. Okay, Lauren Rhodes, and might as well have Ray Hobitzall come forward also. Thank you, but stay close just in case. I mean,
okay, great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and we have been actively involved in the development of these amendments in conjunction with Sarah Reeder of the Association of Oregon Home Care Agencies. And on behalf of our membership, in addition to skilled nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care facilities, we also include membership of licensed in-home care agencies. And in that sense, we were concerned and committed to resolving the issues that Senator Johnson encountered earlier or at last end of last year. And specifically, our idea was to increase the fee amounts for licensed in-home care agencies in order to give additional resources to the department to have the means to enforce the sanctions that are already in some ways in statute but are further enhanced with the development of this amendment. So a couple pieces that I know have the committee has raised questions about in terms of sanctions. A new policy is the imposition of civil penalties if the department finds that an agency is either operating without a license or specifically on page 2 of the amendment, line 30, has failed to provide a written disclosure statement to the client or the client's representative prior to services being rendered. Additionally, for failure to provide the contracted in-home care services or for failure to correct deficiencies identified during a department inspection. Additionally, in these amendments, we, on page 2, line 20 through 22, we do now authorize the department to conduct surveys every 3 years, which prior to these amendments, they were a complaint-driven survey process, and it wasn't a regular survey requirements. So, and additionally, prior to services being rendered, the department shall conduct every 3 years thereafter. So, in addition to increasing their sanctions, they also have the enforcement ability, which on the final page of the bill, lines 10 through 18, permit the department to seek an action to enjoin an agency that's operating without a valid license. And that, I believe, Chairman Anderson, would get at your concern, which is an agency that is unlicensed but is operating and providing, attempting to provide services to clients. Additionally, we wanted to make sure that the clients were protected, and so in line 16 through 18, if an agency is found to be operating by the department without a valid license, they are required to provide notice to their clients in order for the clients to seek and arrange alternative services through another agency.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ray Hobitzall, for the record. And by the way, very few people pronounce it right. Thank you. I am the manager of Adventist Health Personal Care, as well as the Oregon Healthcare In-Home Care Committee, as well as I'm the son of aging parents that live in Senator Johnson's district. I guess to tell you a little bit about our agency is that we provide in-home care services in Portland, Tri-County area. I have about 130 employees. 17 of those are RNs or LPNs, and the rest are caregivers and support staff. The in-home care agency committee at Oregon Healthcare has been looking at this kind of legislation and wholeheartedly supports what we have here. What we've found as agencies is there are people who play by the rules and those who don't. And those people that are a part of our committee play by the rules. And what we've wanted to see is a good, thorough process of review. We also wanted to make sure that if people weren't acting right, that there was some penalty for it. And like Lauren said, really the survey process has been one of they survey some at random, but then also it's a complaint driven and not necessarily are the complaints really that valid? But because they get them, that's where they've been going. We wholeheartedly support this bill and everything that's there. And any question, open it for questions.
All right. Well, thank you. It's an extremely important issue. Yes, Ms.
Chair Sanderson, just again, Sarah Myers with the Oregon Association for Home Care would like to simply point out that a lot of which we have included in the Dash 2 amendments are included in the current in-home care agency administrative rules. However, what this really does is provide some additional teeth, allowing the department the appropriate level of funding in order to pursue such investigations, as instead of doing a self-attestation, which an in-home care agency is now required to do, which basically means they come in with their personnel files to the healthcare licensure and certification office and take an open book test on the rules and subsequently are allowed to receive their license at that time. And again, as Ray and Lauren have pointed out, we simply then have a complaint-driven current process that would facilitate or initiate a survey following that. So this, you know, while there are current rules that would allow that to happen, there really is only complaint-driven, and it is a funding issue. So that, you know, a lot of the various different language in the bill with respect to page 1, where we talk about an in-home care agency shall be required to maintain administrative and professional oversight to ensure the quality of services provided. Again, that's already something that's essentially outlined in rule, but here we felt it would be stronger to add that in to the bill itself to provide additional teeth to the language. And as well as on page 2, where we talk about permitting the agency to do an on-site inspection prior to services being rendered. Really, this should be, you know, something that should be done, and I think the department agrees. And again, a funding issue up until now, so we wholeheartedly support that. And then in addition to that, simply if we have or if the department, rather, finds that there are companies out there that are operating either without a license or out of compliance, this funding will allow them to really go after those folks so that the quality of care and the level of care that is being received by folks in the community is adequately being overseen by the department. So I just wanted to add those comments.
Great.
Madam Chair, one additional point that I did want to bring up was in terms of the fee amount. I don't want to stir that pot too much more. Our initial interest was in raising the initial license fee high enough so that it was a realistic and also a severe commitment on the part of an agency prior to becoming a licensed agency. And so the $1,500 amount seemed like an amount that would warrant a credible agency coming into the operations of a business. So I would just offer that up to the committee in terms of when you're considering that initial licensure fee, something that is high enough that would require an agency to show that level of commitment to providing quality care services.
Member.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I agree with her. I mean, this is obviously a very serious problem that if you're going to discourage people who cannot afford to be in a certain marketplace, it makes it look bad for all of those that are legitimate, that wants to do a good job and that are not doing false advertising and everything else. People who want to live to the legality of the law don't mind paying this to get involved in the business. But what I'm hearing these people say, they think that carrying the cost lower encourages all the fringes to become a part of it. And so I'd like to call Dr. Higginson back up here while these folk are here and see what would be his intent for lowering the cost for being in business. Oh, no. Come back. Because it was you guys' idea.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson with Department of Human Services, and Chair Carter, you know, what we're trying to do here is make sure that we have enough money to run a credible and good oversight program. And so the way we had figured it out was simply $750 for either an initial or a renewal would get us that place. I understand the arguments that are being there, and certainly we would not object to more money coming into the program, although I need again to remind people this is not in the governor's recommended budget. But I also note that one of the reasons that we did not like the way it was a high fee and then a much lower fee for the renewals was right now we're getting very few new in-home care agencies. So like last year, I believe there were less than five, so that really would not be the kind of income that we need for the program in general.
So you balanced out the fees across the spectrum.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'd also like to throw out there, though, is why we also would like to see the beginning fees increased or up to $1,500, is it takes more oversight and it takes an initial startup is more expensive for doing in-home care to the health division. And so we want those costs bore by those coming in and not by the rest. I don't have, to be honest with you, I don't have a problem with paying $750 if it means that I have to, that I'm going to get better oversight, that there's going to be better quality across the industry. I just want to see that when somebody comes into the industry, that they come into it and pay the full fees and not be subsidized by other agencies to start a business.
So why was the $1,500 being changed to $750?
Madam Chair, I tried to explain. I'm not doing this very well. But all we were trying to do is come up with a fee that met the goals, the needs of our program.
Okay.
And we just thought that having $750 across the board would work.
Okay.
The arguments that are being made, I think, are reasonable arguments.
I want to make sure that the agency, that DHS, is able to actually inspect and follow up on these. And if we have not requested a fiscal, but we will request a fiscal on this. It may not be ready by the time, because I do want to pass this out Monday, and we should have the amendments back by then.
And Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and with the standard that we're trying to reach for all of the regulatory programs we have in that program is inspections every 3 years, either by us or a nationally recognized accrediting body, and aggressive follow-up of complaints, and we feel that this bill gets us to there with in-home care agencies.
Then we'll start out this one. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other discussion? Is there anyone else that wants to testify on this bill? Senator Johnson, thank you so very much for bringing this forward. It's an extremely important piece of legislation. With all of us baby boomers getting up there, we definitely want to have good quality care out there. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. And in memory of your mother also. Yeah. Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 958, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 925, Senator Bates. So we will schedule 958 for Monday.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us this evening. My name is, for the record, Alan Bates. I'm a state senator and practicing physician in Southern Oregon, Medford.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney & Crew. We're general counsel of the Oregon Medical Association. This bill was proposed by the OMA and introduced by Senator Bates, and very briefly, and I know you're short of time, so I'll try to keep this as move through it as quickly as possible. Generally speaking, Chapter 441 of ORS requires hospitals to organize medical staff into a functioning body that has bylaws, et cetera, and functions according to the hospital rules. It's very devastating to a physician to have their medical staff privileges either restricted or revoked. It can be a career-ending event. It can be something that, frankly, is a nightmare for them. I have the privilege of representing a number of physicians currently and previously who've gone through these peer review proceedings, and I can tell you that the things that this bill attempts to accomplish relative to medical staff bylaws as it relates to fair hearings are fairly fundamental and we think important to be enacted into law. With that said, I want to point out that the primary provisions of the bill. for your consideration, starting on page 1, line 30. Basically, what the notion is of that section of the bill is that hospitals should not be able to use economic criteria when credentialing physicians. I would submit to you that under subsection 441.055 sub 3E, line 27 of the bill, which is existing law, they cannot do it anyway. But we want to make it crystal clear that economic criteria play no role when physicians are credentialed for medical staff privileges. That said, and possibly the part of the bill that may be of some concern to various people, it can be found at line 17 of the bill on page 2, and this has to do with taking call, if you will. Medical staff bylaws universally require physicians to take call as a condition of medical staff privileges. There's been some concern voiced in the OMA that this was an attempt by physicians to avoid the responsibility of calling the medical staff bylaws. For the record, that absolutely is not the OMA's position, and in fact, we support the notion of physicians to take call. We have proposed some amendments. I hope those have been handed up to you.
The dash ones we have.
The dash ones that make this basic fact clear, and that is that if a physician is not qualified by training or experience, they should not be required to take call. And let me give you an example. I'm involved in this right now in a hospital system up in Portland where a physician who's an orthopedist who's not touched a mangled hand in his life is being required to come into the ER to take call on a patient or patients that have severe hand injuries. When he arrives at the hospital, he informs the physicians in the ER, I'm not qualified to do this. You've got to call a hand surgeon. They say, yes, you're correct, so now we'll call a hand surgeon. The only thing that happened there was patient care was delayed, and we're saying that's inappropriate. Physicians who are not qualified by training or experience should not be required to take call on those kinds of cases. The other thing this bill does, and this is what Dr. Hilsinger testified to yesterday, if she does not, and she did not have professional liability insurance coverage for a period of time, she should not be made to take call. I want to clarify some of her testimony because I was the attorney representing her for a two-year period in a fist fight with her hospital, and that was after 10 years of faithful service, she wanted to drop her OB privileges. She was told she could when she joined the staff. When she attempted to do that, she was told, if you drop your OB privileges, we will cancel your surgical privileges to do gynecology. And that's what that dispute was about. When she finally was able to locate medical malpractice coverage through the OMA, through the CNA program, she asked the hospital, will you pay for this? The hospital said no. She said, well, then I want to drop my OB privileges. They said, if you do, we're going to cancel your gynecology privileges. And that's what that dispute was about, pure and simple. It wasn't about her trying to make the hospital pay for her OB coverage. It was that if the hospital wanted her to do OB, they should pay for it. It was that simple. So, anyway, that's what that section of the bill does. The bill starting on line 21, subsection G, is aimed at the notion of a fair hearing. Keep in mind that this can be a devastating event to physicians if they are ever brought up before their medical staff and go through a peer review proceeding.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, can we back up just a minute, because I'm looking at get back to F for just a minute, or however it's now numbered, and I'm wondering how that works in small rural hospitals that don't have specialists, who they have on call is who they have on call, and the need for them to do what they can. Because quite simply, if it's something very significant, they probably have to be transported to another place. So I'm wondering if that's a catch there that may have impact on small rural hospitals and their call procedures.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if a physician is on the call schedule in a rural hospital and they have the medical staff privileges to provide those services, then under this bill, if they in fact provide those services in their private practice, you'll see on line 8 of the dash 1 amendments, is not objectively qualified by experience to perform unless the physician provides or is willing to provide the same type of clinical services when not on call. what we're trying to point out here is if the physician is not qualified to provide the practice, they should not be made to take call for it. In those rural situations where they need to come in and they are on call, they're going to have to come in. But once they arrive there, and arguably even before they get there, if that patient needs to be transferred, they need to be stabilized and transferred. That's the federal law. That's EMTALA. That's what should happen.
I understand that. I guess I'm just wondering because there are some facilities where the physician on call may not be there. They're just on call because there aren't that many of them. And you get out to some of the B's and stuff like that, and you know, I think if they're the only physician available, even if it's outside of their area and somebody needs to come in and at least stabilize for transport, that should be within their scope, and they should be required to do that.
Madam Chairman, if I can answer that. This comes under what we consider the Good Samaritan law. If you come in and you're in a rural area and there's nobody else there and that patient has to be stabilized and moved out, that's kind of the Good Samaritan acts we have, and the physicians would do that. We're talking about a physician being asked to come in on a routine basis, take care of something that he or she is routinely not qualified to take care of. And I can speak to that when I have a chance here. Your point is well taken, especially in A hospital and sometimes in B hospitals, you can see it happening. But in those cases, you do the best you can. You shift the patient as quickly as you can and, you know, keep your fingers crossed. And we understand that in A and B hospitals, we don't have everything.
And Senator Bates, I understand, and those aren't what you're looking at here specifically, but I always look for things that might get caught in the wash. So.
Yes, Senator Carter. I want to ask General Counsel. Ask Counsel, not General Counsel, excuse me. When you look at this whole argument between doctors and hospitals, are we saying here that all doctors should not have to be on call, but those that are generalists in their practices? Because calling a specialist on, to use your example, maybe an orthopedist who specializes in hands and their specialty is so specific, why would they have to be on call when what they do is so limiting?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, first and foremost, they must take call because they're required to do that as a condition of medical staff privileges. If they don't take call, they can and will be disciplined in a manner of basically invited to leave the medical staff. That said, if a physician, and I had this happen in Central Oregon, if a physician does not do invasive cardiac procedures, they should not be made to take call for that. They are incompetent by training and experience to do that. And that's where we draw the line and say, you shouldn't be able to make that a condition of their medical staff privileges. If they legitimately are saying, I don't do that, and it would be malpractice, it would be inappropriate for me to do that, we believe the physician should have the right to say that and to draw the line. But a physician should not, clearly and unequivocally, should not be able to dodge their responsibility to take call under the medical staff bylaws if they are qualified by training and if they are credentialed to do it.
Tell me, counsel, why is this bill here?
Pardon?
Why is this bill here? What is the situation that brings this bill to the legislature? Okay, I will wait until Dr.
Boy, well, I get to that, okay.
All right. I will tell you it's a problem we encounter time and time again, and perhaps Senator Bates can speak to that. The rest of the bill, starting on line 21 of page 2, is the notion of what constitutes a fair hearing. Now, let's be clear about something here. There is a federal law out there. It was put into law by Senator Wyden back when he was in the House of Representatives as a result of a very nasty case up in Astoria, Oregon. It's called the Wyden Act, the Health Care Quality Improvement Act, I think of 1987, technically. But the point is, it is a permissive statute in the sense that if the hospital or health care facility follows the procedure, then they are exempt from certain claims for violation of the antitrust laws. What we would like to see happen is that the simple notion of a fair hearing be enacted into law and what that constitutes. Notice of what you've done wrong. I was just involved in a case where the hospital didn't want to tell the physicians what they'd done wrong, and I threatened to take them to court if they didn't do it before we got to hearing. Nothing like a star chamber proceeding. We wanted to know, for example, this bill says they have a right to an attorney. That's the federal law. We think it should be the state law. They have a right to cross-examine. They have a right to have a record made. This shouldn't be controversial stuff. It's basically an attempt to make clear under state law that hospitals should, or healthcare facilities should, grant the medical staff those simple privileges of a right to defend themselves, cross-examine, etc. One of the issues that's addressed at the bottom of page 2, line 44, to the top of page 3 is who has the burden of proof? I'm involved in a case right now where the hospital maintains it has no burden. We must prove or disprove a negative. And our point is, look it, you have an obligation as a hospital to prove up. Your burden of persuasion is to prove that your actions were reasonable. Our burden is to prove we're qualified to have medical staff privileges, and we don't shirk that responsibility. But you as a hospital should also have a burden to prove that the actions that you took were reasonable. And that's what we're trying to clarify in that section of the bill. On page 3, line 10, that speaks to the issue of discovery. Physicians have no right of discovery under most medical staff bylaws. We have no way to examine, before we get to the hearing, any witnesses, any documents, nothing. It's kind of like blind man's bluff. Now, I want to, at the request of the state court administrator's office, we would propose to put a period after the number 46 on line 11 to clarify we're not trying to create a new cause of action in court. We're simply trying to say that there should be right of discovery. And those discovery rights go both directions, against the physician, for the physician. So we're attempting to enact into law some right of discovery. Keeping in mind that this can be a career-ending event, we think that's fairly important. Finally, on line 15 of page 3 of the bill, subsection H, physicians are often chastised for being disruptive. There is no clear definition under Oregon law what disruptive means, but the one thing that we do want to make clear in this bill is disruptive does not mean if the physician speaks out in support of health care for their patients. That cannot be disruptive conduct. And I have that situation right now as we speak, that a physician, or three physicians, are being criticized for basically saying this is not appropriate, these patients should be transferred, and they are now losing their medical staff privileges as a result of that. So, in essence, that's the bill.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm going to kind of put a personal look at this a little bit for you and draw on my experiences 4 years of chief of medicine at two hospitals in Southern Oregon. And I'm going to tell you that as I first looked at this bill, I thought of it as you may have just heard it to a certain degree, as a bill for physicians. But as I thought back on my years and as chief of medicine at my two hospitals, I found this more and more as a bill not only for the physicians but for the hospitals too. And I'll explain this as I go along and for the public. And I'm going to take the four major parts of the bill. I'm going to give you examples how this bill actually helps both sides of this argument and what it speaks to. The vast majority of physicians and hospitals will never be touched by this bill. I had about 500 doctors on my staff. Probably I was responsible for about 300 of them, and there was three or four that were just constantly in trouble. And those are the ones we had to work with the most. And we also had issues that came up occasionally that this bill addresses that were hospital-wide. And without this kind of, I mean, I would have loved to have this bill and this law when I was doing that. It would have made my job much easier, clearer, and I think it would have been a lot fairer for both sides. First thing is about economic criteria being used for medical staff privileges. You first think about that, you think, well, we don't want doctors being knocked out of a hospital because of the reasons we just heard. You know, we've got a physician in Klamath Falls who has practiced OB and gynecology for a long time, if she drops her OB coverage, then they are going to have a hard time recruiting another OB doctor because she has a huge practice in gynecology. They can't guarantee the other physician coming in, money, and so on and so forth. If you think of it that way, that's kind of a shot at the hospital. If the hospital shouldn't be doing that in the first place, frankly. On the other hand, go across the mountain range and go into the Rogue Valley. We had something occur this last year in which a completely competent cardiologist wanted to join the staff of one of the hospitals. The hospital had terrible pressure put on it by the cardiologists who were on the staff already in two different groups not to allow this third one in. The hospital was caught in the middle and finally denied those privileges. Within a couple of months, one of those groups decided they did want another cardiologist and brought one of their own in. Hospitals caught in the middle of that crossfire and ultimately had to allow everyone down staff. But if the hospital had this in place, it would have protected the hospital from that kind of pressure from a physician group. None of our hands are clean in these situations. The second part of this bill goes to physicians cannot be made to take call for professional service they're not competent to obtain, to do. When I was chief of medicine, we had a situation where everyone who had primary care training or internal medicine training had to take general call at the hospital. So you have people like rheumatologists and dermatologists and allergists being called in the middle of the night to take care of a pneumonia case. They hadn't seen a pneumonia case in 20 years since they were in medical school. Didn't know what to do or how to do it. And they commonly would get called in. They'd have to call me or somebody else to come in and take care of the case for them. We don't want that kind of stuff going on. It's not good for the public, and ultimately it's not good for the hospital to be placed in that position either because it leads to all kinds of difficulties as far as liability is concerned. Those issues were never completely resolved, and I think this bill goes a long way to allowing that not to occur again. The fair hearing procedures also cut two ways. I went through three very difficult fair hearing procedures. As we got into one of them that was really difficult, we found out that we didn't have bylaws that really spoke very well to it. And there were two hospitals involved, and the bylaws are different in both places. By the time we got through that case, 5 years later, I was up here as a representative and had to get called back down to testify about it. Because what had happened, because there were no clear criteria for what a fair hearing procedure was at both these hospitals, we ended up in court on it. The individual physician sued both hospitals based on the fact that she had not had a fair hearing. This clarifies that, makes it straightforward. Again, this protects the hospital and the peer review process. The last issue here is disruptive conduct by a physician. I'll argue the same case. It goes both ways. You cannot believe what happens when somebody in a hospital setting is accused of disruptive behavior. You can have a true whistleblower. And somebody can go away going after that physician because they don't like something being brought out in public that doesn't look very good. You can also have a situation where you have someone who truly is disruptive and the staff is split. Half the staff will say, well, you know, he's a good old guy, he's been here for 30 years, and, you know, he's okay. Other half the staff saying, this happened to me. This guy has been a jerk for 20 years, we got to take care of this and move it on. We had that kind of a case come through, and we never settled it because the staff was split. It actually had to be settled by the hospital board. That was the only way we could get to it. The idea of going to arbitration and taking it out of that incredibly political atmosphere is the best way to go. If we could have referred that case to arbitration, we would have wrapped it up very quickly instead of it hanging on again for 4 or 5 years. So this bill, as far as I'm concerned, actually helps both sides and the public. That's why I like it. So I've lived every one of these issues. I've lived every one of these issues for hours and days. And to have this kind of clearness and this ability to go to Oregon law and say, this is the way you deal with it, would have been a godsend for me. And I think most physicians and hospitals, after they've thought about this long enough, would see this not as just something that's physician versus hospital. It's something that's good for both sides.
All right. With that, I'd like to call Norm Gruber, Bruce Bishop, Fran Higginson. Bruce Bishop from the Hospital Association, Norm Gruber from Salem Hospital, and Grant from the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
And thank you. Thank you.
And I would like someone to address the fact that Mr. Crew had said that there needs to be a period after 46 on line 11 of page 3.
Hey. My name is Norman Gruber. I'm CEO of Salem Hospital. And I'd like to comment on two parts of this proposed bill. First, with respect to credentialing, and really very briefly, and I'm speaking more from a policy standpoint, and that credentialing is ultimately the responsibility of the Board of Trustees of all hospitals. And that is currently how hospitals function. Ultimately, those decisions around credentialing are approved or not approved at the board level, typically recommended through the medical staff. And I believe from a policy standpoint, this needs to be maintained in a Board of Trustees, not as a legislative issue. It belongs in that area. The Board of Trustees of all hospitals are fiduciary responsible for what occurs within the hospital. And the process that we have set up, I think, is the process that is appropriate. That is, the boards do ultimately have a responsibility to the community as community representatives for the credentialing of the medical staff. The other point I'd like to address is the issue of a call, and I agree that physicians should not be required to take calls that are not qualified to take call. However, I don't think it is as simple as is identified in this bill. As you may well be aware, physicians taking call in emergency departments is becoming a growing problem across the country. Finding individuals who are able to take calls, specialists, as there's a shortage, is a growing issue. There's no question about that. In fact, in many hospitals, Oregon included, physicians now are compensated by the majority of hospitals for taking call, which used to be something that was done gratis by physicians as part of their responsibility on the medical staff. I think the issue of exempting physicians from call based on some of the criteria here is a very slippery slope, and I'm going to give you a very specific example. We had a situation, this is here in Salem, where we were unable to have physicians take call for hand coverage, and you've heard hand before, which hand coverage is becoming more and more difficult, to the point where we had no physicians on the staff who were willing to take hand call coverage. And as a result of what we currently have in place in terms of our bylaws, what we were able to do is construct a relationship with both orthopedic surgeons and plastic surgeons to take call from the standpoint of what they were comfortable doing, and that was based on our core privileges. They could make an assessment of the situation. Making an assessment of a patient with hand injuries is different than taking them to the operating room. That enabled the emergency physician to have someone that they could consult with to make some kind of an assessment on the patient and make an appropriate disposition. That disposition may be to transfer that patient to OHSU, for example, but it created a scenario that we work with the physicians to create some type of call coverage for what would have been no call coverage. And I use that example because I think there can be physicians who are not comfortable or haven't done a particular procedure for a long time, but still in many cases are able to make an assessment without necessarily taking that patient to the operating room. They can assess the situation, dispose of the patient appropriately, and work with the emergency physicians, who are often the ones that are caught in the middle of the night without anyone to assist them in a given specialty. So I think that to allow a hospital and its medical staff to work through each of these situations as they exist and as they may need to be, as opposed to having some legislation that would not really allow the circumstance, for example, we developed to occur. Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing tonight on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I've furnished you with written testimony that expresses the Hospital Association's opposition to Senate Bill 925. I've also given you written communication from Larry Mullins with Samaritan Health Systems expressing his reasons for opposing the bill. I am prepared to go into a more detailed analysis of the bill if you wish. I think Mr. Gruber has explained some of the policy reasons why the bill will actually interfere with the delivery of quality medical care through hospitals rather than in trying to promote quality care, which is the which is the purpose, I think, underlying the bill. It doesn't achieve its purpose. We object to the language about economic credentialing or the use of economic criteria in credentialing decisions. We think that that standard is not well defined. It's not clear what the scope of that prohibition would be. We're concerned that the subject of the bill is actually hospital credentialing, but the bill affects a number of other healthcare facilities than hospitals. It may have some constitutional problems in that regard. There are a number of specific provisions in the bill that are called due process and are proposed as a way of balancing the process by which medical staff laws and physicians operate. In fact, we think they have the opposite effect. If they would have the opposite effect if they were enacted. Overall, we think that this bill is not necessary. It will create more problems than it will solve. We would urge the committee to oppose Senate Bill 925 for this session. I'd be glad to answer questions. And I can go into specifics if you'd like on the bill.
I don't think it's necessary at this point unless there's a question. Thank you. Dr. Higginson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, Administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to voice the department's support of Senate Bill 925. As you know, we license and certify a number of facilities and agencies, one of which is hospitals. What this bill does is create some additional requirements that we would be responsible for assessing when we went out and did one of our routine surveys or complaint investigations. And we've talked before about what we believe is an inadequate frequency survey of a lot of facilities. That's not the issue here tonight. But what I can tell you is that this really would be a very small marginal increase in the amount of work that we do when we do inspect hospitals. And so there really is minimal fiscal impact from the agency's perspective. We are supportive of what we think are some good policy aspects of the bill. We think that determining physicians' privileges based on qualifications rather than other criteria is a fairness issue. We believe the issue of not requiring physicians to take call for services that they're not competent in providing is a patient safety issue. And we also believe that the physician's right to a fair hearing is a due process issue that we would support. So I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Higginson, do you support the Hospital Association's position that this sounds more like a credentialing hospital bill as opposed to a physician-supported or an equally concerned group of people, be they hospitals or physicians?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, from my perspective, this bill, as Senator Bates described, is really trying to do those three things, trying to provide some fairness in how people get credentialed. And I do think that that has some access issue implications. Secondly, the bill talks about what I think is a patient safety issue and making sure that physicians are competent to provide the care that they're required to do on call. And I'd also point out that we actually have rulemaking authority with that provision, and we would make sure in the rule writing that we put in provisions so that physicians cannot use this to dodge taking appropriate call. And also, as Senator Cruz mentioned, put in a provision to make sure that if you are the most appropriate physician to provide services given an emergency situation, that would be something that you'd be required to do as well. And then the final issue is a due process issue, which I think speaks to fairness.
Another question. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bishop, since the Hospital Association is opposing this bill, how do you propose that there could be fairness in along the lines of physicians as they work in these facilities, being hospitals or some other health place facility? How do you see them feeling as if there's fairness and And there is a means for them to object to any unfair treatment they may receive as a result of a facility like a hospital.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Madam Chair, in fact, we believe that the current law does provide a balanced approach that recognizes hospital management's prerogatives and responsibilities to serving the entire community's needs for medical care, while also recognizing the responsibilities of the medical staff to make recommendations about the policies under which the medical staff will operate. If you look at the bill on page 1, line 15, it makes clear that the governing body of a healthcare facility, including a hospital, is responsible for the operation of that facility. The medical staff practices its profession within the medical facility, but ultimately it is the responsibility of the governing body of that facility for the overall operations. But that authority is tempered under existing law on page 2, starting at line 2, where current law makes very clear that the physicians organized into a medical staff shall propose medical staff bylaws to govern the medical staff. So there is a balance between the governing board of the healthcare facility and the medical staff that practices there, and a requirement in existing law that those two interests work together for the benefit of the community. That's what current law requires. We're quite concerned that the additional language in Senate Bill 925, in fact, interjects much more of an unbalanced approach to that, and will not benefit the community in delivering quality medical care to patients.
Do you agree, Mr. Bishop, then that the governing board, basically the governing board for the hospital, hospitals, and maybe doctors don't see them as being fair because they are looking out for the best interest, both economically and social, for the hospital as opposed to necessarily doctors, because you can hire doctors more often than you can build a new hospital?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I'd like Mr. Gruber to answer that because he actually is involved on a day-to-day basis in working with his medical staff.
That makes sense.
And in being responsible for the operation of the Salem Hospital.
Let me see if I can try to answer your question. Now, within the construct of our hospital and most hospitals, the medical staff, by and large, is self-governing in that it establishes bylaws that are pretty detailed in terms of fairness to the physicians, and it addresses a variety of things in the bylaws. These bylaws are ultimately approved by the board of directors. I believe I'm correct in that a board cannot arbitrarily change bylaws of the medical staff without the approval of the medical staff. So the board of governor or the board of trustees of a hospital cannot arbitrarily change those bylaws unless the medical staff agrees to whatever that amendment or change might be. And bylaws typically are reviewed and changed on a periodic basis. But ultimately, the governing body is responsible, and by law, and there's case law, for the quality of care rendered in any given hospital. They are the ultimate arbiters of what's appropriate in terms of quality. It's not just an economic responsibility, it's a quality of care responsibility. And the medical staff in our hospital or any hospital serves under the auspices of the governing body. That is how hospitals function in this country. And the bylaws are a way for the medical staff to function within the context of a hospital structure.
Final question?
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm about to give you a title here. Are you a physician?
No.
Okay. So, Mr., thank you. So let's take the case that Dr. Bates presented a few minutes ago, or the counsel presented, that if a doctor was practicing outside of their scope and they were brought to bear in terms of their responsibilities, and the person would say, I don't want to be able to advise in the area of an OBGYN, and the hospital administrator, whomever else, would say, then you'll do that, else we'll drop you under another area that you're licensed to practice. What course does that person have?
No. I'm not familiar with the case that was, but in the bylaws, I'll speak to our hospital, would allow that physician due process to go through and argue the point that they either aren't qualified. We, for example, have OBGYNs who no longer do OB. They do not take OB call, they take GYN call. They no longer practice OB. They no longer have those privileges. They're typically not insured for OB. They're not required to take OB call. They are required to take GYN call. So the circumstance that was presented is one I'm not familiar with, but in our case, if someone were to require them to take OB call and no longer had those privileges, the physician would have a due process through the existing bylaws. I think that to answer your question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I still think that what I hear the argument being is that still that governing body is there for the purposes of the hospital and not to, and that if you're going to talk about fair hearing, what I think I hear them saying is that they don't feel that the governing body is a fair body by which a doctor can depend upon fairness because they are there as a governing body of the hospital and they say they're there. Medical care.
Maybe just to clarify, a physician first must go through the process identified in the bylaws if they believe that there's an issue, or the hospital as well, from a quality standpoint. Once a physician goes through the hospital's process, i.e. through the bylaws, physicians then can go to court. So there is always a next step beyond the hospital process and beyond the medical staff bylaws process if, in fact, there's a feeling that the governing body acted inappropriately. That is not the end of a physician's rights. They may go and often do go to a court of law.
It would be nice, though, if they wouldn't have to go to litigation. And what I envision where this is going, because Senator Bates, obviously I don't have the votes to get this out of committee right now, but I would like to suggest a work group. If you wanted to head up a work group, or OMA head up a work group, probably OMA is whichever, and to try to deal with this. We need to close. We need to be moving on. But, Senator Cruz, do you want to...
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd just like to clear something up in my mind. Current law, in the authority of the governing body of the facility, current law, which is line 20, page 1, ensure that physicians admitted to practice in a facility are granted privileges consistent with their individual training experience and other qualifications. Could I assume that to mean that when you grant privileges to somebody trained in OB, that is what they're granted privileges for? Would that be a fair assumption?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. Right. Then I go over on page 2, current law, line 17, sub F, which currently says procedures for ensuring that physicians provide services within the scope of the privileges granted by the governing body. And this is in what the physicians themselves organize under. And so basically in their rules, they're codifying as far as their ability to do anything, what they are granted privileges for doing. So I guess I'm seeing from both perspectives, from the position of the hospital, which is run by the governing body, and from the position of the physicians association within the hospital, very strict guidelines to keep people within scope of practice. Wouldn't that be a true statement?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I believe that would be a true statement. I would also point to the committee on page 3, starting at line 25. Current law is very clear that medical staff bylaws are accomplished through a cooperative process involving both the medical staff and the governing body. Medical staff bylaws are adopted, repealed, or amended when approved by the medical staff and the governing body, and approval shall not be unreasonably withheld by either. I think current law addresses the balance that you want between the board of a hospital
the medical staff, and provides a process in which local issues can be responded to appropriately. 925, in our view, doesn't add anything to that, and in fact, goes the opposite direction.
All right, committee. Thank you very much. No further questions. Then I know that there needs to be some work on this bill. I would let the proponents of the bill, Dr. Bates and OMA, to work on amendments, work with the hospital association and directors of the hospital to try to solve some of these. And I certainly will move the bill if you are able to bring amendments in which there is a little bit more consensus than there is right now. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 925 and open a public hearing on 154. And colleagues, we do not have the votes in this committee to move anything except those amendments that would keep Oxford houses in landlord-tenant law. So the people that I ask to come forward, I want you to address those issues. Just the dash twos primarily, and then I know that there was a meeting today, and who's on the list for the 154s? Is it Patty O'Sullivan or is it Bob Nickel? Is it Bob Nickel? Okay. But if I could get the... Yeah, go ahead.
Can I make a statement? Because I'm supportive of the dash threes, and I kind of want to let people know why. And part of my reason, and I understand the concerns people have with this bill and totally exempting them from landlord-tenant, but from my perspective, I don't think the threes do that. I think it allows for rules to be developed that will fit specifically to these organizations. And part of my confidence in this process is my long-term relationship with Bob Nickel and knowing him to be a man of impeccable character, and when he says he'll do something right, he will do it right. And so, Madam Chair, quite honestly, that carries an incredible amount of weight with me. And I do believe that they would develop rules that would be appropriate and protective of all the concerns that people have spoken of here today. But quite honestly, I wish these sort of facilities had been in existence at the level they are now 21 years ago when I could have used one. And I'm glad they're here now, and I want them to continue. And I feel it's unfortunate that because these are special facilities, these are special people dealing with problems that most people in society don't deal with, and at the same time they're trying to deal with the same problems everybody else in society is dealing with. And so to set up a separate protocol for them, I think is absolutely appropriate. And so, Madam Chair, at this point, I guess I'm disappointed because I think we had an ability in the dash threes to accommodate all the concerns and all the legitimate concerns everybody has expressed.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And I, too, am very disappointed that we weren't able to come to a resolution that would make it easier for Oxford House to be able to keep their... to be able to make sure that tenants who were using or abusing and had outrageous behavior could not be dismissed sooner than what the Dash 2s proposed. But I take a look. The reason I want to move this bill is with the dash twos from what majority of the committee wants is discrimination still exists. And I think the timing right now is just poor. Take a look at those wonderful athletes at Rutgers University and what the racist remarks that were made about them and what an uproar it was. Our culture and our society, I think, is just becoming immune to putting other people down. So the timing there, I take a look at the racial slurs that happened in Eugene. I take a look, well, and of course Don Imus and Rush Limbaugh and Jack Savage and Newt Gingrich, I mean, all of them like putting people down, and it's starting to become a culture. And we just have to be extremely careful before we start making it a little bit easier for a group of people that are not under the law to be doing this. I firmly believe that this probably would not happen in Oxford houses. I put before you, committee, in your handouts, the background on Oxford houses and where it started in 1975 in Maryland, and then gradually has gone, you know, just spread all across nationwide. And I've given you some other documents from, I think it was Bob Nickel, and Patty O'Sullivan, I know, has been working on this also. And truly, it's not an easy issue. And I know that they had a meeting today, and it could be that they are going to be able to work a little bit more. But at this point, we need to move this on, and hopefully they can come together in the House with some amendments that are agreeable to Oxford House as well as to the department. And so that's where we're going. But I agree with your sentiments at this point, Senator Cruz. But with that, Ed Johnson and John Van Landenham and Bob Nickel, if you'd all come up. I think at this point in time, unless you can... we can only really address the dash twos and the dash fours because I've talked with each member of the committee and I know where they stand.
Madam Chair, for the record, I listen to Air America and they put people down too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And there, we are, I'm sorry, just one more question. I mean, one more point. The dash ones have nothing to do with Oxford houses, but the department needs that amendment, and everyone is agreeable to the dash ones, just so that everyone knows.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Carter.
I want to be perfectly clear. My support of the dash twos has everything to do with an environment where we have worked for years and years in terms of civil rights. I would do anything and have always been very supportive of people who are coming through activities of recovery. So this is by no means my non-support of recovery activity, but everything to do with the civil rights that many people before me have worked hard to get. And it is mine as long as I live in every fiber of my body to not take away the civil rights of individuals, and especially people that look like me and of color.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Carter.
My name is Bob Nickel, Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, Addictions, and Mental Health Division. First off, thank you, Senator Cruz, for the kind words. I have talked with Patty O'Sullivan just now. She's been working with Ed Johnson and John Van Landenham today. Basically, to get to the bottom line for us is we would prefer to have the Dash 4 amendments. We will work with the other people to see if we can find a blend between the dash twos and the dash fours, and so I wanted to put that on the record.
And another, I was talking with some Oxford residents prior to the hearing, and they are saying that the dash twos are modeled after, and I think they said CCC recovery homes, and the difference between Oxford House and that is they have a case manager and someone, a paid staff, which the Oxford House doesn't. So I think that we need to address that issue too when you continue your talks as this moves along in the process.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landenham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Eugene. We did have a discussion before the, this work session. We are committed to continuing to work to see whether we can get closer to agreement. As the proponents, well, as the opponents to the original bill, we prefer the dash 2. DHS, as Bob Nicholas indicated, would prefer the dash 4. We believe that we may be able to find a hybrid on the House side and reach some agreement, and we are committed to trying to do that. We also, I think both sides support the dash 1, with the understanding that the dash 1 does not retain the amendments to 90.100, ORS 90.110, lines 5 through 6 of the bill. The dash 1 and the dash
Now, explain this again. You say the dash 1, there's problems with the dash 1?
No, it's not. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, it's not really a problem, but just to be clear, dash 1 would add to the main bill some language that we agree would be an exception to the Act, exclusion from the Act. The dash 4 or 2 would replace all of the bill. And if we put the two together, dash 1 plus 2 or dash 1 plus 4, we're okay.
Yes.
I'm capable of explaining the difference between dash 2 and 4 if people want that.
Yes.
And I've obviously confused Senator Horton.
When we take this to legislative council, we will say if we do pass the dash 1s, that they need to be a part of the bill, and the dash 2s to be a part of the bill, and they will blend to. Yes, go ahead.
I thought you said, no. What did you just say about, excuse me?
Yes.
What did you say about dash 4?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, our side prefers the dash 2.
Right.
DHS
right.
prefers the dash
right.
4. Either way, we agree that the dash 1 would be a part of your action.
I thought you said if you put dash 1 and dash 4, you're okay.
Dash 1 plus 2 or dash 1 plus 4.
Well, you're okay both ways?
Either one of those, he's saying he'd be okay.
I don't get that.
But because DHS does not support dash 4s,
They do. It does support dash 4.
They do.
That is incredible what was just said.
2, 4.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. But you're saying 1, 2, or 1, 4?
1 plus 2 or 1 plus 4.
Okay.
And does not dash 4 take it out from under the landlord-tenant line?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, no.
4 does not?
No.
4, what 4 would
does
do?
Not?
For what 4 would do would be to allow them to exclude, to lock out, people who are in relapse, but the rest of their operation would be covered by the Act. I guess you could say it's a partial exclusion from the Act.
It's better than what we got.
The dash twos, in simple terms for me, is a person who is evicted would be allowed 48 hours to move out. The dash fours, the people would be the dash fours would need to be evicted within 24 hours.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's the main.
Okay. We need to recess. Just a minute. We have the votes for the dash 2s. We do not have the votes on this committee for the dash 4s.
Are you in work session, Madam Chair?
Yes, I am.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 925.
Yes, Senator Carter.
154. I'm still on the other one. Sorry.
Senator Carter moves the dash 1 to Senate Bill 154. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 154.
Senator Carter moves the dash 2s to Senate Bill 154. And before we pass it, I would like Ms. O'Sullivan to make a comment.
Thank you very much, Chairman Sanderson. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Department of Human Services. And Bob was taken up with other things, and so I was the one who talked about this prior to the committee hearing. What I don't think that was explained very well is that the fours give you a short-term remedy to the person comes in and they're using and boom, they're out in 24 hours. The twos give a longer term 48-hour plus you have to go to court and, kick them out in accordance with the law. What we would like to do on the House side, and what we've all agreed to do, is we're committed to sitting back down, the group that just met this evening, and working out a hybrid of the two, so that there's a short-term remedy, but then you have to actually go get them evicted later according to the twos. So it's a hybrid of the fours and the twos. We don't have that in front of us tonight. So what we agreed to do was come here and say, we want the fours, they want the twos, it's up to the committee. But we're still going to work, no matter which ones you pass out, work together to get a hybrid to protect the people in Oxford House, but give people an appeal right if they feel unjustly evicted. Mm-hmm.
Is there any other discussion? Yes, Senator.
Just to confirm what was just said, because all parties at that very informal meeting we had back there all committed that they would continue to work. And it's just, I think, the shortness of the time that is forcing us to move it before it's finished. So I have comfort that you're all committed to it, and I appreciate that.
That's right. Yes, Senator Courtney.
Thank you very much. I really was going to say I was hoping the parties get together and go between two and four and do something, because I think if that's the case, I'll be there. So thank you very much for that statement. I feel so much better about what I'm doing here now, even though I was definitely
welcome.
One of the ones for two and one, but I just said there was a bombshell hit me there, and I got very confused.
Right.
Thank you very much.
And Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Courtney, we really believe that, their side understands what needs to happen at Oxford's House. Our side understands that people have due process rights. Mm-hmm. And so the hybrid, I think, would work out really well for both sides.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're
much.
Welcome.
And we do want it to pass on the Senate floor, so this is the best way to go. Yes, Senator Carter has moved the dash twos. Is there any further discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 154 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 154 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and please have Senator Gordley as excused. With that, I close the work session on Senate Bill.
Carrier.
Oh, the carrier is... Do you want me to carry it?
You or me, I don't care.
I'll carry it.
You carry it.
Senator Cruz will carry it. Okay, Senator Cruz will carry it. Great. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 154. And Shannon, which one should we do?
This one's quick and
painless. We're going to do a quick and painless one. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 591. It better be quick and painless. Okay. It's Earls. Yes.
Oh, another one. These are tough bills.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you should have in your packets the dash ones. Oh, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Kaiser Permanente. And you should have before you the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 591.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Okay. And did you pass out this? Okay.
Go ahead.
The dash one, as you recall, Senate Bill 591 has to do with the amount that for researching and copying medical records. The current law apparently has been too low for my client and several other hospitals and health systems to sustain the service that they're providing. And Senate Bill 591 sought to remedy that. The fees that Senate Bill 591 originally imposed were too high, so we worked out a compromise, which you'll see in the dash ones, at $35 for the first 10 pages and 50 cents a page thereafter. And if you look at this chart that I think was passed out today, it'll show you in the first column on the left-hand side, it gives you a breakdown of a couple different numbers of pages, 10, 100, and 500, shows you what it would cost for current law, And then over on the far right-hand side shows you what that would cost under the Dash 1 amendments. So I would not want to tell you that the Dash 1 amendments will pay for the entire cost of duplicating and researching these records, because we will still be losing money in this department, but it will help.
Is there any opposition to this? All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just want to tell you that I'm glad that parties worked together, because I like the Dash 1 amendments better than I did, because I thought the other costs could become prohibitive.
Good job, Betsy. Good job.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. We were supposed to be in a work session, right?
Yes.
Was I in a work session, I think? Well, whatever. I'm going to close a public hearing and open a work session. We weren't supposed to be in a public hearing. Okay, yes.
I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 591.
Senator Carter moves the Dash 1s to Senate Bill 591. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 591 to the floor as amended with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 591 to the floor as amended with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Carter?
I will.
Thank you. Senator Carter will be the carrier. That'll close the work session on Senate Bill 591. Which one's yours? I'm going to open a public hearing on 939.
It's a work session.
I'm opening a work session on 939. But I would like to bring Brian DeLashmet, Rob Nuss, and Dina Garrison to 939. Yeah, and then there's Paul and John. Go ahead, and I'll find it.
Madam Chair, if I could begin. Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. This bill comes to you at the request of the Oregon Nurses Association as a result of a situation that we became, as a health policy cabinet and a board, aware of that's occurring in the state. We believe very strongly, and you will hear from a corrections nurse in just a minute, that this issue, in fact, is a public health issue more than it is directly related to corrections. Mm-hmm. The public health issue here is that the assessment of health and mental health needs or drug issues are essential, especially with the population that we're talking about in this bill. Issues such as TB, Hep C, HIV are exceedingly pervasive in populations, and from a public health perspective, it is important to assess the public health threat both to the other inmates and to the public as well when these folks are released. So what we're asking you is to pass this bill, and we do understand that it would have some interrelationship with a local mandate. So we would like it sent to Ways and Means so that the discussion can occur in Ways and Means in both in conjunction the Public Safety Subcommittee and also the Human Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means as to the public health implications of this bill. And with that, I'll leave it to the other two.
Okay. Thanks, members of the committee. My name is Rob Nose. I'm with the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm the staff rep with the nurses up there at Multnomah County. And the legislation is designed to ensure that good health outcomes are provided for in county jails. The risk to the public is intense when we have a population that has a far greater risk of exposure to contagious disease and is confined in space for a short time and then released. Additionally, we're concerned that many inmates suffer from mental health conditions and go undiagnosed and untreated in jails that are not staffed appropriately. For lack of a better system, jail has become the mental health treatment system for a lot of places in our state. And these mentally ill inmates are likely to get worse, become violent with corrections workers, frequently receive more severe sentencing as a result of their behavior that their illness is triggering. So this bill ensures that standards are in place via accreditation so that health care in jails is appropriate. Go ahead, Dina.
My name is Dina Garrison. I'm a corrections health nurse at Inverness Jail. By way of background, it's been since the 1970s that the highest courts of our land ruled that health care for people who are in jail must be provided. Over many years, my employer, Multnomah County, has worked hard to administer and fund a program that provides medical care to people in its jails and uphold the law. We run an appropriate program with appropriate care. While not extravagant in the care that we give, it's equivalent to what a person would get going out into the community to an ER. As you might imagine, the people that myself and my co-workers serve are not the most politically popular. People in jail have very few powerful advocates. For the protection of the inmates, correction staff, county residents, Multnomah County had historically provided for its program to be accredited through the National Commission on Corrections Healthcare. The accreditation, just like JCO for hospitals, and ensures that minimum health standards for jails are met and maintained. It also provides liability protection to the county, and those inmates armed with lawyers and less than honorable intentions will have very little ability to pursue a successful lawsuit on poor health care treatment because the accreditation ensures an appropriate standard of care. Our own commissioners in Multnomah County are confused by this.
We're last year. That's when they took it away.
Accreditation is not just some good housekeeping seal of approval. It's a means that nursing processes are in place to ensure that disease and health status of inmates are monitored and appropriately treated.
So like many counties in this state, Measure 5's property tax cap and then the recession in the early part of this decade has taken its toll on our budget and our programs. And we've worked hard, the nurses have, with our administration to be more efficient, but just like healthcare expenses everywhere else have gone up, they've certainly gone up for people inside of jail as well. And in a short-sighted move on our county's part, they decided not to fund the nursing staff that are needed to maintain the accreditation standard. They were laid off as part of a $2.7 million budget reduction to Corrections Health. And to put that in a context, that's out of a $13 million budget. Now, not all of that $2.7 million pays for accreditation, but it was a chunk of that. If a law were in place that required the county to maintain accreditation, this would not have happened. That budget cut in a $1 billion budget would have been made somewhere else. The commissioners that championed this cut are no longer with the county. They're not on the board anymore. And while our program today, the one that Dina works with, is mostly intact, there is no external standard in place that we hold ourselves accountable to. So our fear is that over time, especially if the county's budget situation continues to worsen, the staffing, the care standards in our jail will further erode, and we'll see some sort of lawsuit like other jurisdictions in other parts of the country have faced. And so if you Google anything on the web relating to corrections health, you can get very scary stories in major newspapers in just about every city of bad outcomes that happen in corrections health setting that we have not experienced because of the way the county has historically provided for an accreditation.
The other piece of this is that accreditation ensures that public health is looked out for. Many people in jail do not have health insurance or get regular health care. The procedures that an accredited jail undertake look for communicable diseases and help prevent the exposure to those diseases by members of the public when our inmates return to live among us. Accreditation makes sure that the public health is not overlooked in the jail. The nursing procedures are in place and are offered to all of the inmates so that good care is provided and the public is protected from diseases.
That's it. Thank you, and we'll answer any questions.
Okay. Is this a staffing issue?
Yes. I mean, the accreditation requires that certain nursing procedures be done at regular intervals, regular times, and there have to be staff to do those things. And so when Multnomah County said, we don't want to do that anymore, they were then thus able to reduce staff and then reduce the corrections health budget.
So you're saying that truly in order to provide proper care to those who have dual diagnosis or mental disorder in the correction systems, there truly is not enough staffing, nurse staffing, there to care for them in the correctional system. Is that?
I don't think I would want to say that there's not appropriate staffing, though I think at times that is certainly the case, given whatever acuities people are dealing with inmates that are there. What I'm saying is that there's not a standard in place to ensure that the staffing that ought to be there on an ongoing basis is in place. And so our fear is that over time, the county is just going to further erode and erode the program till we get to a point where I could say with more credibility, yes, I think the staffing in the jail is bad, it's unsafe, and that people who get care there are in trouble.
Madam Chair, if I may, my history in the building, my 30 years in the building, I would put this as akin to what we've done with mental health system and the public health system outside of the corrections arena. We, in fact, have moved these to the local level and then not funded them. We put less of a importance on making sure that public health is an access point that people in the general public have. It is the only access point they have. And with the types of diseases that we're talking about in this population, we find it extremely important that these people, in fact, have the ability to be screened, not only for the mental health issues, drug issues, but also for the communicable disease issues that they have, and will, in fact, then bring into the facilities, but then ultimately take back out of the facilities and expose the public. So that's why we feel it's very, very important.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I think what I hear them saying, and they can correct me, is can be found on line 11, section 3, subsection A, a local correctional facility, a lockup, as those terms are defined, ORS 169.005, that does not use an accredited healthcare system shall adopt such a system no later than July 1, 2008. And it would just appear to me that if we are calling for an excellence in science, i.e. medicine at this one, across our healthcare system, that the jail facility should not be any different than what society expects at large in terms of having the appropriate type of skill sets in this particular place, using the kind of national accreditation healthcare system in place, and just because it's a jail, it should not relieve them of their duty and responsibility to the healthcare arena. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
That's
what I think I hear you say.
Madam Chair, Representative or Senator Carter, sorry for the demotion.
Well, that's
very briefly. That is exactly the point on the head.
Yeah.
And again, we fully understand that this, in fact, does have some monetary implications. What we're asking of you is this the right policy? Is this a policy that makes sense? And then let's pass it down to Ways and Means. We have had discussions with different members of the Ways and Means Committee, especially in the public safety area, and they are anticipating this bill, so at least it can be incorporated in the discussion about community corrections, about corrections in itself. And essentially, there may be some interaction with your subcommittee, Senator Carter, as well.
Thank you, and I'm glad you called on Senator Carter first. So I apologize for being outside, but I was talking to the folks from Oxford just to tell them, don't give up, never give up, and which is important. To hear Mr. Glassman say that this is going to Ways and Means, because I was reading an unfunded mandate here. So so if it's going to Ways and Means, at least that can be addressed there. And I would also point out that this also speaks to the critical need for funding for the local mental health system, which we have discussed in this committee as well. So in that context, I can support it. But I was assuming you were just doing policy and creating an unfunded mandate because the SMS doesn't have a subsequent referral. But with that, I have a lot more comfort.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, you were out of the room when I started, and that's one of the first sentences out of my mouth. We understand that it, in fact, is an unfunded mandate that would need to go to Ways and Means and be a part of the broader discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other just questions? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And I'd like to call up Paul Snyder, AOC, and John Powell, Sheriff, representing the sheriffs. And I guess there's no one from corrections here, which I am surprised.
Well, sheriffs are part of that, so.
Oh, it's local. It's not DOC. Thank you.
You don't want me.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and appearing this afternoon in opposition to Senate Bill 939.
Your watch.
This evening.
Tonight.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the National Commission on Correctional Health Care describes its accreditation as a voluntary health care proposal. It's aspirational. It's the Cadillac. It's the kind of thing you'd like to do if you have all the money in the world to get everything done that you want to do. Mm. It confers many benefits. It promotes and documents efficiency. It lends prestige to programs. Madam Chair and members of the committee, our jails in the state are not in a position to go to a place like that right now. We'll be lucky to keep some of them open if PL 106393 doesn't pass. And if, well, just in the case of a number of different jail conditions, I understand that Multnomah County will be revealing its proposed budget on Thursday afternoon, and it's not going to be especially pleasant when that happens. And that's a county that's not nearly as affected by the safety net as other counties are. Standards are a great thing to aspire to, but in the world that we live in Oregon right now, we can't afford it.
Madam Chair, members of the
and
committee.
I just want to comment on that, because that's really tough to hear. We need to have high-quality services, and there's such a need for services, yet we need, and it's such a burden and a burnout with staff in these facilities. Having worked in public health, we would provide some nursing services to the Clackamas County jail, and we'd go over and do some tests, et cetera, because they didn't have nursing staff to do the HIV testing, to do the TB testing at times, so we were asked to go in and do that. So I still will say I so wish that the public would know why, what services are needed so desperately, but then what services are not being given that we need to give, and that's a tough sell. So just comment on that. Yes. John Powell.
And Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Members of the committee, the sheriffs understand the need for quality health care in the jails, and in fact, some of the things the previous witnesses said about avoiding lawsuits and that sort of thing are very important. So in fact, even in shortages of money, they attempt to keep as many of those services as they possibly can. And I know that it's a difficult squeeze, because if they fully fund this equation, then there's something else in their facilities that goes undone and a need unmet. And the same with all of county services. So if you simply plug this hole with one set of standards, then the balloon's going to pop out somewhere else and some other function is not going to be well funded. So we wish we could meet all these standards, and many jails do. I just talked to Linn County this afternoon. They're not only accredited, they're up for accreditation review here in a few weeks. They're visited by the accreditation faculty, and all of their procedures and things are scrutinized. So many of them are, in fact, meeting standards that this bill would require. However, in dire circumstances, decision makers at the local level who have that responsibility of determining where you best put your dollar, I think are going to have to be trusted to do the best with what they've got. And we think this bill, while very well intended, probably goes too far. We will, in fact, participate down the Ways and Means area to see if there isn't something that can be done, but things are tough there as well. Thank you.
Questions? All right. We're in work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes, just a minute.
That's right. We did not post this with a public hearing. It was an error. So we cannot pass this bill today because we need to have a public hearing, even though we had a public hearing right now. So we will post a public hearing for the next available time and have this a public hearing. And then I would like each staff to give me input as to where they want to go with this bill. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 939. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 360. And, colleagues, the next three bills should be fairly straightforward. They are ways and means bills. We have all of these bills with ombudsman. Everyone wants an ombudsman. I even had legislators come to me saying, I want an ombudsman. So... a legislative ombudsman. So I think these are bills. There's so many different ones. There are some that came out of the Health and Human Services. I think they all need to be in Ways and Means where they can all be together in looking at these things, because we truly don't have the money to do each one of these, and it would be nice to have them consolidated, and maybe next session we might put all of the ombudsman bills together and working with the departments to figure out how to address this issue that it seems like every group wants to have. So with Senate Bill 360, who wants to speak on 360? Okay.
Awesome. Just want to kick them without recommendation.
Yeah. Will you move?
Sure.
Yeah.
Chairman Sanderson, my name is Don Bischoff. I'm a legislative assistant to Senator Bill Morissette, who could not be here tonight. The committee has already heard the testimony from Tim Baxter, who's here at my right, who's the principal advocate for the health care ombudsman. He's outlined the need for that. I think Senator Morissette would be happy to see this go to Ways and Means, and hope that we can make the case there for getting it funded. Tim, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Tim Baxter. I'm a legal aid attorney in Eugene. This bill was heard on March 12th. Nothing more to add. Of course, happy to answer any questions. We understand that it's a cost bill, and we understand there are others out there competing for their 15 minutes in terms of ombuds services. But we'd be grateful to get this to Ways and Means so we can continue this discussion there.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Senator Cruz.
I'm assuming you're supporting the -1 amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
I should have spoken to that. They were introduced at the public hearing back in March, and Senator Morissette is very much in support of those.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Senator Cruz?
Why is that redhead sitting there?
Senator Cruz, I certainly didn't invite her.
The chair did. So.
Well, I just thought it was kind of it's a nice contrast. But.
The two of you have spoken. Ms. Becker?
Thank you. I'm members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the executive director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which is an association of 11 of the 14 Medicaid managed care plans. I did also speak on this bill earlier in the first public hearing, and we are opposed to this bill, primarily because there already is a grievance process that is well articulated in our contracts with the department, as well as in policy. We have to provide information to the department on any grievances. There is an entire procedure laid out. Clients are notified of that procedure. And we also use information as we provide that to the agency if there are trends or issues that makes its way into the quality improvement process. We believe that adding an ombudsperson, a separate ombudsperson, is going to add costs, at least for the managed care plans, to a system that is already in place, and we think it is duplicative. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 360.
Senator Cruz moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 360. Questions? Discussion? Any objections?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 360 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 360 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Is there a discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Senator Gordley is excused. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 360, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 363. And again, this is a Consumer Advisory Council to advise Director of Human Services on provision of mental health services. Actually, Shannon, that's your job. Okay. And we have, again.
Chair Mona Sanderson, I'm Don Bischoff, Legislative Assistant to Senator Bill Morissette. With me is Gina Nickel, the Director of the County. I can never get her title right. She'll introduce herself when the time comes. You heard testimony on 363 and 364, and we have you have amendments before you to both, but I want to speak to that issue. Senate Bill 363 would establish an ombudsman within the Mental Health Division. 364 is sort of 363 light without the ombudsman and without the fiscal impact. It would simply put in place some policies that even the department itself believes are good policies. The amendments that were discussed when this was subject of public hearing, we believe that 364 with the dash, are they dash?
One.
With the dash one amendments would be a good bill to pass, and it's not going to cost any money, and the department welcomes this with open arms. The amendments that we just got, the amendments this afternoon, the amendments to Senate Bill 363 are not what Gina had discussed with Legislative Council, and we would urge the committee to pass 363 on to Ways and Means, where the issue of whether there's money there to pay for an ombudsman can be discussed at more length. Gina may want to add something.
Just clarification, Don. So at this point, you're talking about 363 without the dash ones.
That's correct.
Okay.
363 as is, 364 with the dash ones.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And I promised the next time that I would testify before Senator Carter that I would give myself the appropriate title. For the record, I am Dr. Gina Nickel. Okay, satisfied the Senator. Go on. I want to point out...
You know, that was a good straight line. I'm going to let it go.
Senate Bill 364, if you look at the dash one, do you have the dash one?
No, wait, now wait, we have, yes. 363. But
let's deal with 363 first.
Okay, 363, our recommendation is to pass them out to Ways and Means Committee without the dash one.
I'd like to move 363 to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 363 to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. All right. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 363 and open a work session on Senate Bill 364. Same people. Go for it.
Gina Nickel, and I would put on the record that the dash ones established the Consumer Advisory Council. I want to remind you that that is no extra money, because that is already happening. We just want to put that in statute if the director were to change. Don't plan on that happening, but would like it in statute. The piece that has a little bit of money attached, not much, and it has not been used yet, is line 15 on the dash ones. Members of the council are entitled to compensation and expenses as provided in ORS 292. That hasn't been done, but I wanted you to know that that is in the amendments.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
How much do you surmise or suspect that that would, the cost would be?
Madam Chair, can I invite Bob Nickel from the Department of Mental Health?
The nickel that isn't a doctor?
That's right.
Okay.
Come on, that's not a doctor.
Madam Chair, for the record again, Bob Nickel, Assistant Director, DHS and Addictions and Mental Health Division. I would have to get my pencil out real quickly, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, to get a quick read on that. As Dr. Nickel has just said, we have not reimbursed people so far for travel reimbursement. Some of the counties have actually been helpful in seeing the people who are actually from Eastern Oregon are able to get in. So they've absorbed that cost. I would, I'd need to really go back and do some figuring. I could do that, but you probably want to pass this bill along. I think the fiscal impact would be minimal, probably under $10,000. I would do everything I could to absorb that. Frankly, it would be a little bit easier for me if that line wasn't there, since we've been able to do it without that. So those are my thoughts.
May I ask a question, ma'am?
Yes, please.
Mr. Bishop, would you care if that line was deleted? Would that bother you?
Let me consult with Senator Carter. May I consult with my technical advisor here? Senator Carter, we would have no objection to removing that line.
I'm sorry, you'll have to explain where we are here.
Sure. We're talking about line 15 on the dash ones to Senate Bill 364, which entitles the members of the council to compensation. Senator Morissette would be happy to see that line removed.
Great. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Since we're in work session?
If we're going to make that major, it's going to have an amendment.
Even if we extricated it, even if we deleted it?
You want to do conceptual?
Can we do
I'm not comfortable with that.
You know, that's the trouble with having the president on the committee. It makes it really hard.
Yeah, the other thing, Madam Chair, and Senator Courtney raised his hand, actually, but if even if they kept it in, and it's less than $10,000, it does not have to go to Ways and Means.
Oh, but I like having it written as what we want in statute, and I'm just not comfortable.
Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Carter is chair of the Subcommittee on Human Resources. And given the condition of the budget, which is becoming much more obvious with each passing day,
yes, sir.
Even $10,000 is a lot of dough, so maybe the chair's direction should be followed.
Right. Well, and I will not go against the chair's wishes, but I think the thing that happened is that Mr. Nickel, in his own words, would say that he could absorb the cost within his own budget, and even though he would prefer it not to be here. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment that you get that we would delete line 15 in the dash one. 15 and 16 in dash one amendments to Senate Bill 364.
Thank you. And staff, do you have note that, and you'll submit those amendments? Now, I just want to ask a clarification. In the regular bill, it requires that at least 20% of the membership of all task forces. Commissions, advisory groups, and committees have persons with mental health and addiction issues be consumers. Is that taken out? I mean, that's the summary, and I'm trying to find where
in the written, oh yeah, in line 12, at least 20% of the membership has to be consumers. Is that taken out?
Chairman Sanderson, I don't believe it is. If you'll see in the dash ones, it says in line 12 they're deleting 2 and inserting 3. That's to get the numbers correct. But line 12 stays. That section stays.
Okay. Having served on task forces, commissions, advisory committees, sometimes it's extremely difficult to get 20% consumers. I know in nonprofits we have a terrible, terrible time. I'm a board member on Human Solutions on affordable housing, and we have between 15 and 20 board members, and to get 15% of consumers, I'm not sure what 15% of 20 is, but it is, just a minute, 15, carry the one, is three, that means three out of 20 members must be consumers. And maybe that's appropriate. I need to get some feedback to make sure that we're not setting some of these commissions up to having not being able to meet statute.
Chairman Sanderson, the person who asked Senator Morissette to introduce this bill, Drake Eubank of Springfield, runs a mental health self-help organization called SAFE. I think he could guarantee you that he would have more than enough people there of the consumers that this is something the folks who are consumers of mental health have been wanting for a long time, and I think you'll have no problem filling that, but I'll defer to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we could easily get 20%.
Excellent.
You know, a couple of years ago it may have been more difficult, but we've got a very active, healthy, alive consumer movement in this state.
That's wonderful. That's what I like to hear.
I also want to say at most local levels, the number is 51%. It's got to be 51%. And so 20% was a number that Drake and others chose as a minimum threshold.
Okay. And we have testimony from Megan Cahey, who's in the audience. She just wants to make sure that her testimony is put into the record. And she is definitely in favor of both 363 and 364. Yes.
And Madam Chair, just say, I'm glad that, I mean, it does say minimum of 20%, and with NAMI and the other mental health advocacies that we got going in the state, they're very active. I don't think we're going to have any trouble filling the hole or the void.
Madam Chair, just while she's coming, I'm being intimidated by a member of this committee.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry that I
introduce yourself. And
I'm Megan Cahey.
Why do? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I'm used to this. There was pure advocacy and action going on at the beginning when the bill was introduced. So I'm sorry that I missed the remarks at the beginning of when the work session was begun. I have some concern about splitting the advisory council and moving that over into 364. The proposed amendments of 363 are okay with me in terms of omitting the ombudsperson section, but the deletion in 363 of the Consumer Advisory Council.
We're in 364 right now, so let's just put the comments on 364, and I'm sorry that we didn't have you come in to talk about 363.
Okay, I was doing the peer advocacy part, which is my work.
Okay.
364, I must say that I believe that the advisory, I'm sorry to refer back to 363, but I must do so in
That's
my
okay.
answer.
Just so that
I believe on. That the advisory council belongs in Bill 363 rather than in Bill 364, which the amended section was moved from 363 to 364. I think
we need to have someone clarify that. Would Mr. Nickel or Dr. Nickel please explain?
Senator Monis Anderson, yes. I think
John,
I can explain.
Can you do?
Since we're not amending 363,
yes.
the advisory council also stays in 363, and it's also in 364, correct?
So
we're not going to do any of the amendments. Because the amendments came back in a couple of instances that were incorrect, were not what we requested, we've recommended and the committee has adopted 364 as it now stands without recommendations.
That's 363.
Senator Ways and Means.
363, Don.
I'm sorry, 363 has been accepted by the committee and sent to Ways and Means without amendment. In other words, they've sent the original 363. They've passed it out.
Thank you very much. I commend your leadership.
All right. Thank you. All right. We're in work session.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Move Senate Bill 3.
No.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. We can't move this because we are going to get that amendment. All right. All right. With that, thank you very much. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 364, and we're adjourned.